Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Ken Nash. Mimi will be back next week. Today we mark the 6th month anniversary of the World Trade Center disaster by focusing on two issues of continuing concern in the post-911 era. Later in the show, a pre-recorded interview by Mimi with David Sobel, General Counsel of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, on the Patriot Act and new government electronic surveillance powers post-911. But first, we welcome to the studio Joel Shupro, Executive Director of the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health, and Ekaterina Malievsky. I butchered your name. Say the last name.
Ekaterina Malievsky.
Who helped her to staff a mobile unit which treated mostly immigrant day laborers for occupational injuries from a van near the World Trade Center site. The van was jointly sponsored by NICOSH, the Center for the Biology of Natural Systems at Queens College, and the Latin American Workers Project. We'll talk about safety and health issues around the World Trade Center site in Lower Manhattan. And let's start with that van. Ekaterina, why was it necessary for that van to operate?
The initial idea behind this mobile unit was that we wanted to serve the population that was least protected. Those are the people who, the day laborers, we serve the population of day laborers. Those people are recent immigrants, primarily Latinos. They unorganized, they don't have any really steady, stable relationship with their employees. They shape up on the corners hoping to get a job for a day or for a week or for a month. And this is the category of people that is really difficult to trace down, to put together and characterize their health problems. So we wanted to serve the people who are very disadvantaged compared to firefighters or police department.
I should mention that we became aware of this problem. An organizer from the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health went down to Broadway and Fulton Street, where workers were shaping up, and began to talk to them about their experience. And what we found was not only were they not being provided with protective equipment, they weren't being paid at the outset. And so at that point, we brought in the Attorney General office to ensure that they received remuneration for their work. But as we talked, we became more and more aware of the types of problems that they faced on the job.
And what kind of problems, what kind of health problems did the day laborers have?
Well, their health problems really fall into two categories. They have a lot of respiratory symptoms, such as cough, congestion, shortness of breath. They repeatedly said, "My lungs hurt." That was a very common complaint. Also, it was remarkable that they had a lot of systemic symptoms, such as headaches, dizziness problems, sleeping problems with memory. These symptoms really don't have any visible explanation at this point, but we're going to work on this. We're going to analyze the data. It's just their symptoms are so consistent across the board, we have to think that it's related to their exposure.
These workers were doing what was the most dangerous work in terms of disturbing settled dust from the Trade Center. Once you're outside, the dust had been dispersed by the air and diluted. But what the problem that these workers faced was disturbing dust, which, according to the EPA and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, was characterized as containing asbestos-containing material. And so when you disturb this dust, it becomes airborne, and these workers were exposed. And there were numerous pictures in the press as elsewhere of these workers cleaning without protective equipment or wearing improper equipment, not having decontamination facilities. So they were being exposed to asbestos-containing material at levels which could be quite high.
That's true. Actually, OSHA recommended to treat any dust that comes from World Trade Center as dust containing asbestos. But yet, people were sent to the sites around the Ground Zero to clean it with literally bare hands. They were given just rags and no personal protective equipment. They were not told what they were going to be exposed to. So it's really... At some point, we tried to contact the companies, the cleaning companies that had contracts downtown Manhattan, and some of the companies had up to 1,800 employees at that time. So it's thousands of day laborers that were sent to clean up our mess, and they were exposed to known human carcinogen and a bunch of probable human carcinogens without proper protective equipment.
And was this just at the World Trade Center site, or are we talking about inside the offices in the area, the outside construction that's being done in terms of digging up?
Well, the nature of their job is that it sort of like falls into three categories. They do cleaning, they do demolition, and they can work as helpers to construction workers. So they did all these three kinds of jobs. And it's primarily in big buildings around the Ground Zero. Very few of them really worked at Ground Zero as construction helpers, but they clean big buildings around the Ground Zero, such as Verizon, Century 21, Financial Center 2, I think. Many, many buildings around the Ground Zero.
Now, what's interesting is that even though OSHA now will say publicly that this is asbestos-containing material, really, they did not make that statement public until January. It was in a letter in response to a union that had written for an inquiry about how they should proceed. So we had workers who were working, even though I would say on the site, OSHA was telling people to wear respirators, they really did not make it a public announcement. And EPA had the same position. EPA's position was you have to consider it as asbestos-containing material. But if you also look at the material that they put out, they kept on saying to workers, well, it's safe. And it's often, they said, below 1% asbestos, therefore technically not under their definition asbestos-containing material. And so we feel like the agencies provided workers with false assurances and did not exercise public a proper public health approach to dealing with what is a very potent carcinogen.
Is it only asbestos we're talking about here, though?
Well, the problem is with standards that we have. The problem is that we don't know much about different chemicals. In other words, we don't really have standards for outdoor, for indoor air quality. We have OSHA recommended standard for occupational exposure, which is 1%, which is the number everyone is fascinated with. But in reality, it's the number that has just historical background. It really doesn't have any human-based studies of its safety. So there is no substantiation that 0.5% of asbestos is really safe or is better than 1%. And short-term exposure, according to OSHA, can go 100 times more, can go up 100 times more than long-term exposure, which is 1%.
I think the reason you focus on asbestos is that there is a known standard. There are a wide range of other chemicals that were released in that in the collapse. And we know that there was mercury, dioxin, lead, to name some of the chemicals that were released. There was fuel that burnt that was PCB contaminated. But I think part of what was revealed in this catastrophe is that the infrastructure, the regulatory infrastructure, is totally inadequate to deal with the types of exposures that people had or to deal with the health risks. These are standards that were not necessarily based upon public health or science. They were standards that, as Katrina sorry, That's Peter fine. Said, but you know, were historically derived. They are not necessarily sufficient to protect your safety or your health. And so the consequence is that we had this discrepancy between the agency saying, well, everything falls within our standards, and at the same time, we had hundreds, if not thousands, of people who were experiencing adverse health outcomes, becoming sick with upper respiratory problems and other types of problems. And this, you know, so we had this chasm that existed between the agencies who were issuing these reassuring statements and the reality of what people were experiencing.
When you say inadequate, though, I mean there are charges that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Administration, did not relate to people who were doing things in New York, the study of the U.S. Geological Survey or other studies. Is it an inadequacy that we're talking about, or is it, as Representative Nadler says, a cover-up?
Well, I think you have several things going on. First, you have a public health infrastructure which has been woefully underfunded for years. And at the same time, you have a catastrophe the likes of which we have not seen, on top of which you had the anthrax crisis. And so in many ways, I think the whole regulatory framework was overwhelmed. They were just not prepared or able to deal with this sort of situation. At the same time, you had a drive, which I think emanated from way up in the White House, to reopen Wall Street. That was the first and foremost position that the administration had. And, you know, the attack happened on Tuesday. That was categorically imperative that Wall Street open on Monday, and you had agency heads making statements about which they had virtually no data. So it's a complicated story about what happened, but there were people who I think knew better who were making statements that were not appropriate.
I would say that it's actually amazing how New York with this many hospitals was actually unable to address this health crisis. The physicians know very little about environmental exposures and health problems related to environmental exposures. Another problem is that this approach actually demonstrates how issues of health and safety is not really ingrained in our work ethics, in our everyday practices. And that's what Dr. Stephen Levine, the medical director of the Mount Sinai Center for Occupational Medicine, called public health malpractice. I think it's a very representative statement.
What about right now? I mean, we're talking to some extent what happened last year, to some extent what happened last month. Are things different now? And in terms of that also, are we talking just about the effects of the World Trade Center disaster, or are we talking also in terms of all those trucks that are down there right now cleaning up, all the construction that's, I mean, there's a lot of activity down there. Is that contributing to the soup, I guess, that's in the air?
Well, it certainly does, although probably not to the extent it was, you know, responsible for the symptoms initially. But it certainly does. And on top of it, the events of the last year, I think, brought up other issues that we sooner or later should, you know, be dealing with. Again, I would like to, you know, go back to this group of people that we saw, the group of people that was sent to clean up the site. We really don't have any health system for immigrant workers, although they do have a lot of medical problems, and eventually these people do tend to stay. These people will cost probably more by any means, not a specialist in cost effectiveness analysis, but I think we should rather deal with this earlier than later. Another thing is that I think this event and this tremendous number of measurements that we're taking should be treated as an opportunity to maybe reconsider or confirm the standards that are accepted right now. And we can sort of treat it as a Framingham of our time, the start really, you know, big prospective studies about all kinds of environmental exposures. And in that sense, I think the registry of people whose health might have been affected by events of September 11 should be implemented.
Ken, I think there is a model that we can look at that is different than and how we could have proceeded differently. If you remember Gramercy Park about 10, 12 years ago,
right,
when 200 pounds of asbestos was released into the atmosphere, the Department of Health declared...
It was like water pipes that exploded?
Steam pipes that exploded in Gramercy Park. 200 pounds of asbestos were put into the air. The Department of Health declared a public health emergency. They evacuated the area. They wrapped the buildings that were contaminated in plastic. They sent in professional crews to clean these buildings. And it took over 5 months for this operation to take place. Three buildings they were really talking about. Here we had hundreds of tons of asbestos covered lower Manhattan. And they sent, and the Department of Health did not declare a public health emergency. They sent people back in and told them to mop it up with a wet rag. They did not even ask them to wear respirators at this point. So, you know, I think that that sort of juxtaposition of what happened at Gramercy Park and what happened here, it's very stark. These were, according to the Department of Environmental Protection, cleanup that was supposed to take place is supposed to be regulated. They're supposed to file for a permit to do the job. 35 permits have been filed for Lower Manhattan since September 11th. 35. Do you know how many tens of thousands of jobs have been done?
Right. Well, permits
from the Department of Health, you're talking?
Department of Environmental Protection.
Okay.
Their asbestos control program.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we... convey this message to you at some point when we were doing the screening that although the condition of these people's employment was to have an asbestos removal license, the procedures were not actually followed. And that raises the question of whether the office buildings and department stores were properly cleaned.
Right.
So if the dust is disturbed at one place, it ultimately settles, you know, the next building. And it disturbs there. So 5,000 tons of asbestos that was sprayed over during the construction of World Trade Center is settled down somewhere if the procedures were not followed.
That's right. I mean, there were no clearance procedures or standard that was applicable. There were no standards. We asked the Department of Health to promulgate a clearance procedure so that workers, when they came back into their buildings and residence, would have some sort of standard by which they could evaluate whether the job was done correctly. Really, workers were at the discretion of their employer, who said that it was done correctly, or residents at the discretion of their landlord. And whether procedures were followed correctly or not, you know, our belief is that in general they were not followed appropriately, and so there is questions about whether the cleanup has been sufficient. And for example, in Libby, Montana, which is a site where the town has been contaminated with asbestos, the EPA has gone into people's homes and found that they have not been able to get asbestos dust out of furniture, rugs, and so forth. No such effort has been made here to determine whether the cleanup of fabric, drapes, all the things that are in people's
kitchen appliances,
air conditioners. You know, let's just look for a second. The Department of Environmental Protection and Department of Health, I guess, are releasing automobiles that have been found in the World Trade Center. They're being sent out now. What's going to happen? These are not buildings that automobiles that have been cleaned. They're sending them with a note to the owners about how to clean them. But can you imagine these cars are going to go into shops where workers are going to be exposed. They'll be traded on eBay. They'll be in the environment. Some people may take it seriously and clean up the dust that is in the car, but others are not.
So what, I mean, Representative Nadler and a lot of people in Lower Manhattan are saying that the Federal Emergency Management Agency should take over this and that actually the federal government should pay. I mean, that's sort of separate, I guess, from somebody coordinating this. I mean, what should be done at this point? And another question is, by whom? Is it the city that should be doing something? Is it the state? Is it the federal government? If it's the federal government, should it be FEMA, EPA? What's to be done, and who's to do it?
Well, you know, there is a task force of the elected officials from this area called the Ground Zero Task Force, and they have recommended that there be a city agency or a state agency. I think they're talking about a city agency being created or being given the responsibility. I don't know whether they're talking about a new agency being created, but I think that is one of the major problems that we've faced, is that there has not been one agency that has been responsible or accountable in this situation. In fact, we've had just the opposite. We've had agency after agency saying, well, we're not responsible for indoor air. We're not responsible for outdoor air. You know, and so the people's health has lost has fallen through the cracks in this situation. We need an agency that steps in and says, this is the plan, subjects it to public discussion, and takes responsibility and is accountable to the people.
Is anybody listening? I mean, is Mayor Bloomberg listening? Is President Bush listening? I mean, it seems to me as if it's more than confusion. It seems to me as if somebody doesn't want to do this.
Well, there have, under pressure from the community and from organizations that have been active around this issue, I think there is some forward movement. I mean, there's new task forces being set up by the EPA to look at indoor air. Mayor Bloomberg has appointed a task force. I think we'll to look at the air quality, but I think it remains to be seen whether these organizations, these new entities, do what is needed.
And Ekaterina, the day laborers that went to the van. Now, I understand that the van itself is not now operating.
No.
Is there still a need for that? And what happened to the van?
We actually were overwhelmed with the response. Initially, we were concerned whether we're going to scrape up 200 workers to screen and get an idea about their exposures. But we pretty soon had about 500 people on the waiting list. There's still about 300 people waiting for the services, although we saw about more than 400 people. We were there for about 5 weeks. There is a tremendous need in occupational health services and general medical services for this group of people, and environmental health services for residents of Lower Manhattan. Some residential groups are very concerned about their health, and they do have symptoms. They report symptoms similar to the symptoms of our patients. So we actually brought up an issue of immigrants' health at the latest city council on Friday. And it seems like, you know, we'll be able to take it to up to the chamber and maybe start working.
You know, what we saw down at the van was just the tip of the iceberg, because you have immigrant workers shaping up throughout the city, corner after corner, all of whom who do not have health insurance, all of whom are doing the dirtiest, dangerous, most dangerous work in the country, our sense is that they have occupational health problems, but they also have regular medical needs, which are not being met, and for which I think the van is probably a good model that needs to be expanded and brought to throughout the city to where workers are shaping up.
Jill, I wanted to ask you a last question about the air quality in the area for those who are walking through the area, for those that live in the area. Do you think there's a concern, or is there anything definite we can say?
Well, you know, since the fires have gone out, there has been less of a concern for people in the area. Most of the tests seem to indicate that at this point of time there are, you know, that walking in the area is not hazardous. That's not to say that for workers who are working on the pile still doing the excavation work that they should go unprotected. No, that's just the contrary. They are still disturbing dust, which is hazardous and should be wearing protective equipment. And I would say that for people, the being outside is not the issue. Disturbing settled dust is the concern that we still still have.
And I'd like to thank my guest, Jill Schufer, the Executive Director of the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health, and Dr. Ekaterina Malieska, who is from the Center for Biology of Natural Systems at Queens College. Stay tuned. This is WBAI's Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, and we'll be back after a short break. This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report over WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial. And if you want to get in touch with the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health, the number is 212-627-3900. That's area code 212-627-3900. And continuing on our exploration of important issues in the post 911 error, we have David Sobel, General Counsel, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, talking about new government surveillance powers in the post 911 era, interviewed by my partner, Mimi Rosenberg. Take it away.
I'm very pleased to have David Sobel, General Counsel of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. David, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why don't we start by discussing how the anti-terrorism, the USA Patriot Acts, really affect government surveillance powers at this time?
Well, the Patriot Act significantly expands expands the ability of the government to conduct electronic surveillance. And I think it's important at the outset to understand that prior to the enactment of the Patriot Act, electronic surveillance has always been seen as an investigative technique of last resort, something that because it is so sort of uniquely invasive, Congress and the courts have really tried to limit it to only those cases where the government could demonstrate that its use was absolutely necessary. So the Patriot Act really is a departure from that traditional philosophy of limiting the use of electronic surveillance. So in addition to the expansion of the circumstances under which electronic surveillance can be used, the Patriot Act also significantly limits the ability of the courts to play an active role in overseeing and regulating the use of electronic surveillance. So obviously, time will tell, but it appears to be the intention of the Justice Department to significantly increase the amount of electronic surveillance that's conducted.
Is what we're facing today really the result of the activity of 911, or catch us up on that and give us a kind of crisper idea of how much that has to do with the kind of surveillance that we're facing?
Well, I think prior to September 11th, it has been a long-standing objective of agencies like the FBI to increase their authority to conduct electronic surveillance. In the last few years, there have been a number of proposals put forward by the FBI and the Justice Department to increase the wiretapping authority to extend it more broadly to the Internet. And Congress had been very skeptical and apprehensive about those proposals. And I think what we saw after September 11th was the creation of an atmosphere in which the Justice Department saw that it could finally have many of these previously controversial proposals finally enacted. So, it was certainly interesting to many of us to see that within days of September 11th, there was a very lengthy, comprehensive piece of proposed legislation that came out of the Justice Department. And it was obvious that these were not provisions that had been written in the wake of September 11th. These were things that had basically been on the shelf for several years, and as I say, I mean, proposals that Congress had not been willing to go forward with. So clearly, September 11th created an environment in which many of the concerns that had surrounded expanded use of electronic surveillance largely disappeared on the part of Congress.
And to what extent did the new procedures for surveillance lack the privacy protections found in Title III of the statute governing the interception of actual content of a communication? And, of course, we're talking in the electronic context now.
Right. Well, I mean, that's kind of a big question, because there are a variety of methods of electronic surveillance. I think where we've probably seen the biggest expansion is the extension of some of the traditional authorities that existed in the telephone environment to the Internet. I think the best example of that is what's known as pen register authority. Now, this is a law enforcement power that arose within the telephone world that enables law enforcement to, in effect, have attached to a particular telephone line a device, a so-called pen register device, that enables them to record the numbers, the telephone numbers that are being dialed on that particular telephone line. There's another type of device called a trap and trace device, which allows for the collection of incoming telephone numbers to the monitored telephone line. So that is generally something that we refer to as transactional surveillance. It doesn't actually intercept the content of the telephone communication itself, but it gives law enforcement the ability to basically track the communications of a subject and at least know who that person is communicating with. Now, in the telephone environment, that doesn't raise the significant privacy interest that it raises in the Internet environment, and I'll just take a minute to explain that. In the telephone world, the installation of a pen register only enables law enforcement to collect the telephone numbers. There's no way technologically that the installation of that device will give the police the ability to listen to a telephone conversation. And for that reason, in the telephone environment, these are two very distinct technologies, and as a result, there are different legal standards for the use of a pen register on the one hand and a wiretap on the other. It's very easy for law enforcement to get a pen register order. They merely need to file with the court a certification that the collection of the telephone numbers is relevant to the ongoing investigation. A judge receiving that certification really has no discretion. He or she is required by the statute to authorize that activity. A wiretap, on the other hand, is much more difficult for law enforcement to obtain. They need to make a showing of probable cause. They need to demonstrate that there is no other feasible way to collect the information that they're seeking through the wiretap. So we have traditionally recognized the distinction in the amount of privacy that is afforded to a list of telephone numbers on the one hand, and the actual content of the telephone conversation. Now, that works well in the telephone environment because, as I said, the technology really allows for that distinction. But one of the things that the Patriot Act does is it extends that same pen register authority to the Internet, and law enforcement claims that this gives them the ability to track email addresses, for instance, so that if they are monitoring a particular email account, they can basically compile a log of the email addresses to which the person they are interested in is sending email and from which the accounts from which they are receiving email. So far so good in terms of, you know, possibly analogizing to the collection of telephone numbers. The problem, though, is that the technology is different. And in order to monitor email traffic, in order to collect that addressing information, law enforcement, in effect, needs to gain access to the entire electronic transmission. Internet communications travel in what's known as packet mode, which means that a particular email message, for instance, might be broken up into 10 separate packets to go out over the Internet, and they end up being reassembled at the end destination. Now, if law enforcement needs to and has the authority to monitor this traffic to gain access to the email addresses, they necessarily also need to collect all of the packets that form the actual content of the message. So, although the Justice Department has characterized this change as being something that just seeks technological neutrality in the law, the practical effect is that it gives law enforcement access to much more information under the authority of a pen register order than they have had in the telephone environment. I think the important thing to understand is that the nature of Internet technology makes it much more difficult to allow law enforcement to do something surgical, like just collect email addresses, than was the case in the telephone environment.
David, so let's turn this into something real now. Some of our listeners may have heard of, but I'm not sure everybody knows what Carnivore is, and how do the things that you just discussed with us impact on, I don't know if you'd call it a system, but a mechanism like Carnivore,
right,
for surveillance?
Well, Carnivore is, in effect, the pen register-type device that the FBI has developed for use on the Internet. And what Carnivore does is it monitors all of the traffic, all of the packets that are moving through a particular Internet service provider. So if the FBI obtains a pen register order directed to the email account of a particular individual, what they will do is they will go to that individual's Internet service provider, or ISP, and order that ISP to route all of the traffic moving through that system into the FBI's Carnivore system. The Carnivore system will then, in real time, monitor all of the data moving through that ISP and filter out, depending on how the FBI configures the system, filter out and collect specific packets of data. So that really raises two problems. First of all, with respect to the individual who is the actual target of the investigation, the Carnivore system, in effect, gives the FBI the ability to collect not just the email addresses associated with that person's communications, but the full content of that email traffic. Now, possibly the larger implication is the effect of that process on everyone else who uses that ISP, because, as I said, the Carnivore system routes all of the traffic moving through the ISP to this FBI-controlled system. So we really are left with an unprecedented situation where all of the communications moving through a particular provider are, in effect, being delivered to the FBI, and we're basically left to trust that they are only picking out and collecting those communications that they're actually authorized to collect. And that's a situation that never arose in the telephone world because, again, in the telephone environment, this type of activity can be done surgically, so that if your next-door neighbor is subject to a pen register order and they're being monitored to create a log of telephone numbers that they're dialing, that technologically has absolutely no effect on the privacy of your telephone line. In the Internet environment, it's entirely different because all of these packets that are associated with the communications of all of the system's users are traveling together in one stream, and when we're talking about a pen register or a wiretap in the Internet environment, suddenly everything is being delivered to law enforcement. So it's really a very fundamental departure from the surgical way in which this kind of surveillance has been done in the past.
David, there's a case going on in New Jersey that actually on its face seems to be dealing with gambling.
Right.
But has much greater implications for some of the things we've begun to address. Elaborate on what's happening there and what the significance in the legal arena and for all of our rights is going to be as a result of that case.
This is, as you say, a gambling prosecution against a defendant named Scarfo, which is now pending in the federal court in Newark. And it raises an interesting new wrinkle to all of this, and that is that even when the FBI is able to obtain electronic data through the use of a system like Carnivore, their surveillance activities can still be thwarted if the electronic data that they're obtaining is encrypted through the use of powerful encryption technology that's now readily available. So they might intercept an email message, but then find that it's been encrypted and they can't decrypt it. So what happened in the Scarfo case was the FBI suspected Scarfo of operating a gambling business, and they conducted a search of a computer and located encrypted files on his hard drive, which they couldn't open. So they determined that they needed to find a way to capture his password that he was using to encrypt these files, which would basically give them the key to open the encrypted files. So they obtained a court order from a magistrate in Newark that authorized them to secretly break into Scarfo's office one night and install something in his computer that would give them the ability to monitor and capture all of the keystrokes that he was entering on his computer keyboard, in the belief that at some point during the use of his computer, Scarfo would be entering his encryption password. This was in place for several weeks, during which everything that Scarfo did on his captured by the FBI surreptitiously. At the end of that period, they came back and retrieved the password, were able to open the encrypted files, which they concluded were, in fact, records of gambling activity. Scarfo was indicted, and at that point, all of this activity came to light when the defense asked the obvious question, which was, how did you gain access to these records, because Scarfo knew that they were encrypted. So all of this information concerning the use of this key logger system came to light. But the technical details of it were not made public. The FBI took the position that the technology that they used was classified. Scarfo argued legitimately that he couldn't really make suppression arguments to challenge the constitutionality of the search against him unless he knew precisely what the government had done, and he argued that he needed access to this device in order to assess its constitutionality. For instance, there was the question as to whether or not this constituted a wiretap, because it presumably would have the ability to capture any online activity that he was engaged in while this device was on his computer. That was significant because the FBI had not obtained a wiretap warrant, which is much more difficult to obtain than a standard search warrant, which was all they had. Another question that he raised, which had constitutional implications, was whether the use of the keylogger system constituted what's known as a general search, which is unconstitutional, on the theory that all the FBI was authorized by the court order to obtain was his encryption password, but that obviously through the use of this system, they were collecting everything that he typed on his computer. The FBI ended up prevailing in its argument that Scarfo was not entitled to the details of what had been done, what had been placed on his computer. The court ultimately upheld the FBI's claims of classification, and at the end of December, the court ruled that even though Scarfo's defense team had not been given access to the full details of the keylogger, that the evidence obtained through its use could be troubling new possibilities in terms of the surreptitious use of techniques that are classified, and we really now are looking at a situation where, for the first time in our history, the government can conduct searches that they are not going to be required in court proceedings to fully explain, and that really is a new wrinkle on all of this.
Another new wrinkle would appear to be that really the increased sharing of investigative information.
Well, yes. I mean, another thing that the Patriot Act does is it removes the traditional lines that we've had and the barriers that we've arranged. Domestic law enforcement activity on the one hand and foreign intelligence collection on the other. And these are distinctions that go back many years, I mean, at least to the immediate post-World War II period when the CIA was first created in the late 40s. And Congress at that time was very concerned about a powerful intelligence agency possibly playing any domestic role. And as a result, the National Security Act, which was enacted in the late 40s, specifically prohibited the CIA from having any domestic police function. That same concern arose in the mid-70s in the wake of Watergate when the Senate Church Committee investigation documented extensive misuse of the intelligence agencies' powers and the use of intelligence material and intelligence powers for domestic political purposes. So there were even more restrictions put in place in the mid-70s. The Patriot Act really removes most of those protections and allows for really cross-pollination and increased sharing of information collected by law enforcement agencies in domestic cases and intelligence agencies for foreign intelligence purposes. So I think we're really now seeing the creation of a unified law enforcement / intelligence community that is really something that we haven't seen before.
Well, all of this, we now can have break-ins. We don't have any longer, it would appear, from law enforcement agencies. There's delayed notification of physical searches. Are there any challenges? Have I also missed some other critical components of this? How do we begin the process of protecting ourselves, particularly for those people who are active and more likely than not going to wind up being the target of domestic surveillance?
Well, I think that's what makes all difficult and creates a real challenge. I mean, so much of this activity that is authorized under the Patriot Act is going to be done surreptitiously. In many cases, even the court orders that are served on telephone companies or internet service providers are going to include provisions prohibiting the disclosure of the fact that there even is a court order. So all of this is really going to be very much under the radar, and I think it makes it very difficult to initiate any court challenges. I mean, typically the only opportunity to challenge the constitutionality of electronic surveillance is in a criminal case if evidence obtained through surveillance is entered into evidence, and then there's the opportunity for the defendant to attempt to suppress the use of that evidence. But if the information is being collected for so-called intelligence purposes, just to, you know, basically give agencies an ability to keep an eye on things with no necessary intention of initiating a prosecution, then there's really no way to know that the surveillance is going on or to ever challenge its legality.
And you've been listening to David Sobel, General Counsel of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, speaking on new government surveillance powers in the post-9/11 era. Tune in next week to Building Bridges, where we hope to have a discussion on the economy of New York City in the post-9/11 era. For Building Bridges, your community and labor report, this is Ken Nash in solidarity.